This is Stateside. I'm Max Johnston, in for April Bear. Deepwater sculpin are tiny fish that lay at the bottom of the lake bed. They're relatively prevalent in the Great Lakes, but their nests are extremely hard to find. In fact, never before seen. That is, until fisheries biologist David Jude found a nest 600 feet underwater in Grand Traverse Bay. He joins me with John Jansen from the School of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Hey, guys.
Glad to be here.
So, David, I want to start with you. My boss sent me this story because I don't go outside very much. I'm not very familiar with the wildlife around me. Let's start off with the basics. Deepwater sculpin. What are they and why are they cool?
Well, if you went out and trawled in the middle of Lake Superior or Lake Ontario or Lake Michigan, guess what you'd catch in your trawl? Deepwater sculpin. And most people don't go out to 1,000 feet and do any trawling to pick up what fish are out there. So it's probably relatively unknown to most people, but it's a very important prey fish. They're fairly small. They get up to about 5 inches long. They're important prey for predators out there like the lake trout. And most fish managers, obviously, are cognizant of their presence out there and their importance. So one of the interesting thing that's happening right now with all the different changes going on in the food web, with quagga mussels coming in, and then our reduction of phosphorus and nitrogen because of our straightening out of the sewage treatment plants and all their dumping of sewage into the Great Lakes, is that the lakes are undergoing a thing called oligotrophication, which means that there's being a big reduction in nutrients in the lakes. And that has had some profound changes in the food webs in all the Great Lakes. And one of the things that has happened is that the deepwater sculpin numbers have been starting to decline, and we're concerned about what caused that. And one of the other actors in this scenario is the round goby, which you probably never heard of either, but it's an exotic species that came in from the Black and Caspian Seas in 1990. And I just happened to be the one who found the first one of those in the St. Clair River. I was doing studies there. And they're a very aggressive, pugnacious fish that John and I did research on initially, and we published a paper on its impact on another related species to the deepwater sculpin called the model sculpin. And there's five different sculpin species in the Great Lakes, and they're sort of distributed by depth, with the model sculpin near shore and the deepwater sculpin offshore. So they're a very important link in the food web, and we're concerned about what has caused these declines. And we're also concerned, since we already have a pattern of gobies causing a species to essentially go extinct wherever they overlap with them, the model sculpin, we're concerned about what the round goby might be doing to the deepwater sculpin. And the way that the gobies affected the model sculpin was by sort of surrounding the nest and overcoming the male that guards the eggs, and then they eat the eggs and destroy reproduction. So the obvious thing was, well, how do deepwater sculpins spawn? And will there be a problem with round gobies attacking their nests too? So I've always had this passion about trying to figure out where deepwater sculpins spawn, because no one has ever documented it. And I went down on a submarine back in 1986 when they brought a submarine into the Great Lakes and tried to look into this, but it was during the summertime, and deepwater sculpins spawn in the wintertime. And they also spawn out deep, from what we think. So I've always had this idea, it'd be really interesting to find out where they spawn so that we know what impacts the round gobies might have on them. And the second question would be, are there round gobies out there with them? The gobies do seasonal migration where they're near shore in the summertime and then they move offshore in the wintertime. And we have some data from other studies that shows they go out pretty deep. And John has also published a paper on the seasonal migration of the round goby. And so we know a little bit about what's going on. And then, because of the interest I had on the deepwater sculpin, back in 2015, I asked a colleague, and I asked John too if he could come, but he was busy. And he was actually busy during the time that I did the study this time. And so he was not able to go out with me, but we've done a lot of work together with remotely operated vehicles. So I asked another friend of mine, Hans van Summeren over at Northwestern College, if he could come, and he said yes. And then I contacted an Indian commercial fisherman out of a Peshwabis town at the Duhamel Harbor there, and asked them if they would take me out and look for the deep water sculpin and see if we could find any nests out there.
And John, going over to you, why are sculpin so hard to find, especially the deep water sculpin? Why do they love deep waters?
Well, the deep water sculpin, it's hard to find them shallower than maybe 200 feet. I think I've seen them maybe a little shallower than that, but that's why they're deep water sculpin. And they're not hard to find. It's hard to figure out their spawning because based on the larval fish, which Dave did a lot of work on in the past, they have to be spawning in the winter, which is a hard time to get out. So it's a combination of depth and winter that makes it hard to figure out exactly how this fish is spawning.
So on that note, when you find one spawning, as David did, I mean, that's got to be a big deal.
Oh, it's never been documented before. What was documented during the dives that Dave was talking about in the mid-1980s was depressions in the bottom of Lake Superior that people thought, I wonder if those are deep water sculpin nests. But you actually have to find the eggs to show that that's a nest. So this is the first demonstration that those depressions have eggs in them. To me, that's huge. There's another huge thing about this to me, which is we had these remarkable dives in Lake Superior in the 1980s in which people said, wow, Lake Superior works in ways that we weren't thinking about. And then the submersible operations pretty much vanished to just a little bit that actually mostly Dave and I were doing with lake trout. I'm hoping we're going to get a resurgence of use of submersibles, which actually should happen because it's cheaper, they're less expensive, they're better, et cetera. So it's sort of like looking at Mars. Everybody knew what was going on in Mars until we actually sent rovers there. And then we found out it was entirely different. So in the 80s, we found out the bottom of Lake Superior wasn't what we thought it was. And then we abandoned it because it was expensive. And I think we're going to get back into it and find out that the Great Lakes, the deep parts of them, work in different ways that we don't anticipate.
Yeah, one of the points that John and I always talk about, too, is that if you take an ROV down and examine what fish are out there, you suddenly find out a couple of interesting things. The first one is that deep water sculpin and round gobies will bury themselves in the mud. And so if you run a trawl over that area, which the USGS does in order to estimate the biomass of these prey fish, they're missing a big number of those fish because they bury themselves when they hear the trawl coming. And the second thing, and John has done a lot of work in this area as well, if you go out and look at a sandy area and look at a reef that has rocks in it, you'll find all the fish are hiding out among the rocks. And yet the trawl never samples those particular areas. And so there's a big problem with estimating biomass using trawls that was readily obvious once we went down there and looked around with an ROV.
Yeah, sort of an odd thing for me is that at the time that Dave was diving in Superior, like 1986, with a manned submersible, a couple of weeks after he was diving with it, I was diving in the North Atlantic, same submersible. But I was doing it in salt water. And a lot of the ideas that we've had come from comparing those two things. Why is Superior like an ocean? Which it is. It's not a lake. It's misnamed. So fix that. You're the Great Lakes State.
I'll get right on it.
David, I want to go back to you. You've spent decades researching sculpin. Take me through this moment when you were 600 feet beneath Grand Traverse Bay. Take me through that moment when you first saw the nest. What was going through your head?
Well, as I said, I had done work in 2015. This is the first time. And, you know, it was sort of a fortuitous opportunity. There was a gentleman at the University of Michigan who bought a fishing tug. And he sent out an email and says, anybody want to take this thing out? And I thought, yeah, would you do it in the wintertime? And he said, yes. And so I went out with him and I got a hold of Hans. And on December 23rd, I think, in 2015, right before Christmas, we went out with the ROV. And I thought it was probably a little bit early because we think they spawned sometime in February, but I didn't know. And I didn't know where either, you know, what depth are they at? And so he took me out. We did 5 hours worth of ROV, and we didn't see very many deep water sculpins. The ratio of gobies to deep water sculpins was probably 20 or maybe even 30 to 1 at that 215 steady. And we were in 200 to 400 feet of water during those ROV runs. And then I did another one in March, and we found a similar thing, not very many deep water sculpins. So I was very disappointed. And I thought, well, maybe I need to go to Lake Michigan or to Lake Superior. So I talked to a number of my colleagues all over the place and asked them if they would take me out on their ships, and nobody would agree to it. And I actually asked some other commercial fishermen if they would take me out. Then it turned out that this time, and I've got a place in Sutton's Bay, so I was close to this area. And I thought, gee, this is a good opportunity because, again, the Lake Grand Traverse Bay was open. And so I asked an Indian commercial fisherman named Bill Fowler if he would take me out, and he said yes. And so with that history, and what we found out, I thought, well, we got to try out deeper. And there's a 600-foot spot out off the Mission Peninsula in Grand Traverse Bay, and it took us an hour to get out there. And it was just a spectacularly flat, calm day. That doesn't happen very often, which turned out to be a great thing because we probably wouldn't have been out there as long as we did. We probably would have just tried a few spots and then left. So at that point, the first thing that happened, we went into a cloud of alewives, which was surprising. I've never seen so many alewives, and they were swimming all over the place. There probably were 200 or 300 of them. And I thought, holy cow, all the alewives are out this deep, which, you know, we knew alewives also moved offshore. So after that, we spent probably 2 hours looking around in this one site at 600 feet, and we saw all kinds of deep water sculpin. They were all over the place, and the ratio of gobies to deep water sculpin shifted. There was probably one goby now to about 20 deep water sculpin. So that encouraged me in that I knew there were a lot of deep water sculpin out there, and we did run into a few depressions that looked exactly like the nests that we thought they would look like, but we didn't see any fish in the nest. And then after those 2 hours, we moved to another spot that Bill thought we should try. And we went down there, and again, the same thing. We saw deep water sculpins all over the place, a few gobies, and I was getting extremely disappointed. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to spend all this years and time trying to find these nests. And because there were so many deep water sculpin swimming around, I thought, well, they must be done spawning because, you know, you'd think some of them would be on the nest by then. And then Hans has a side scan sonar on the ROV. And all the time while we're out there, he would pick out depressions and logs. And actually, we found a dead Chinook that was being eaten by round gobies. All kinds of really interesting things, trees and some exposed limestone bedrock, we think. Some really interesting things out there. And the last 10 minutes of the time we were out there, we're going to leave, Hans said, oh, there's some kind of a depression on the right. And we went over there, and it was a branch. And as we got closer, I could see, well, there's a depression next to it. And as we got closer yet, I looked inside, and there was a deep water sculpin sitting inside. And then we got right up on top of it. There was a clump of eggs sitting right next to it. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe that we actually found a nest. So I was really, really elated. It was quite the discovery.
John, I want to go back to you. I mean, why is it important to go to such extreme lengths to find this fish?
How many hours do you want me to talk?
Well, I guess to summarize, like, I've never seen a deep water sculpin, and I'm willing to bet I likely never will in person. Like, I hear all this, and you know, it's so clearly powerful to David. Like, you've touched on how important this fish is. What makes you not only like invested in as a scientist, but also personally get invested in finding one?
Yeah, okay. So we'll be pragmatic first. As Dave said, this is a really important forage fish for fish in deep water, which are in Lake Superior in particular. There's a deep water strain of lake trout called Siskoet. And there's also the only freshwater cod in the lakes, which is burbot. So it's an important prey for that. And as far as we can tell from the trawl data, dragging a net on the bottom, the deep water sculpin numbers go up and down. And if you're going to understand how that happens, why it happens, you have to know the basic life history. So this is just basic life history. And then going back to the more general stuff, what Dave was saying about was you're finding sort of surprising things on the bottom. So back when I was doing some work in the Atlantic, scuba diving and working with submersibles, the thing that we said was that conventional sampling is analogous to trying to study hummingbirds from helicopters. Okay. What would you know about a hummingbird and how it pollinates flowers, et cetera, if all you did was collect them in a net and look at their stomachs? You know, you would throw away the sugary stuff that's in the stomach, which is the nectar from the flowers, and pay attention to the bugs, et cetera. When Dave was going on about things that he was seeing, like, wow, there's gobies hanging around a dead Chinook salmon and feeding off the carcass. Wow, there's trees down here. The impression you get from a trawl is you pull up a tree in the trawl and you're mad and you're like, I want to get rid of this thing. Well, maybe it's important because it's habitat, like this stick that this sculpin was hanging around on.
John Jansen is with the School of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and David Jude is a now retired research scientist at the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. Thank you both for this conversation and joining Stateside.
Fish on.
Well, you're faking being retired.
Yeah, that's true.